All right, so Genesis chapter 6 and 7 and 8 cover the story of the flood, which is a fascinating story. I wish that the Holy Spirit had written a book on it, much like creation. You know, creation is, you know, a chapter or two. And you're going, really? Because I want more about that. You know, the flood is, like I said this morning, the single greatest climate change event since the creation. And we just don't do that. I mean, the Lord talks about judgment, the Holy Spirit doesn't go into a whole lot of detail about what it was people were doing. But it just says the intent, as we see verse 5, the thoughts of the heart was only evil continually. So God decided, it says that he regretted what he'd done. But he found favor, in chapter 6, says, found favor in a man named Noah. And as we know the story, him and his family were saved because he instructed Noah to build an ark. But I'd like to focus on, because it's an interest of mine, is the evidences of the flood. I think that is a opportunity to build faith as we read about what God did, and then we can observe some things. We go, and any time that happens, and Ken Holliday brings this point up a lot in archaeology, everything archaeology does is continue to confirm what the Bible wrote about, even though a lot of skeptics were there. When you hear about the world's view of a global flood, what do people generally think about that? Fairy tale? Localized? That's a very common one. It's not given a whole lot of credibility. I was actually surprised by a statistic that I read, and this is from 2004. People's opinions can change a lot in a short period of time. Percentages of Americans that believe in the flood. I was surprised that it was as high as it was. I was heartened. I was encouraged by that high percentage. What do you guess that is? Percentage of Americans that believe 65. You were very close. It's 60%. I won't even ask anybody else. 60% of Americans believe in the account of the flood. And I think that's great because what surprised me about that statistic, it can't be much higher than people who believe in God. So I guess what that tells me is that those people that believe in God believe in the biblical account of the flood. But I think this is a really good opportunity. Just one more thing I think we can talk about with our friends about. Just one more thing, to just enter into our conversation and be talking about God and then leading on to, if there's a God, then let's talk about spiritual things. Because if there's a God, then everything that he said is accurate. So Genesis 6, God's going to destroy the world by a major flood. Those people that have a problem with a global flood, what would they say would be the reason why that can't be? Where'd the water come from? And where'd the water go? Because that's a lot of water. Anybody here been on a cruise? Because I just did my first cruise last year. You know, some people in the cruise. And I, other than flying over an ocean, I've never actually bobbed in the middle of an ocean for any appreciable amount of time. And I just thought to myself, man, that's a lot of water. We were just doing a cruise between the Hawaiian Islands, and we just cruised for a long time, and it was a long time, and I didn't see any land. I was really glad to see land every time I saw land. Just like when I'm flying, I'm really glad to be on land. So there's a lot of water. And it's people are going to say, where did that water come from, and then where did it go? It says in chapter 7, verse 19, the waters prevailed so mightily on the earth that all the high mountains under the whole heaven were covered. And that's pretty... what's the high... I don't even remember what the highest mountain is, but I know that Rob wants to climb Mount Kilimanjaro. What is Mount Kilimanjaro? About 15,000. Yeah, okay, so is Everest... Everest is the highest one, and that's probably... I mean, that's oxygen. You're carrying oxygen. That's a huge amount of water. No, I mean, some people may make the point that, you know, the mountains may not have been that high, and this is a catastrophic event. Where the water came from, if this was written by a man, and he's making this up, somebody then took an incredibly good guess, or in my opinion, a good guess, when he said in chapter 7 that there's two places the water came from. It came from the rain, but it also says the fountains of the great deep burst forth. And so there's two places. There's water that's coming down, from, and there's water that's rising up. And it rained for 40 days, and at that point it was covered. I want to just go real quickly through some verses throughout the Old Testament and also New Testament that make reference to the flood, because this was a, anybody ever heard of a watershed moment? And I guess this actually not where that came from. Watershed moment is, you know, it's a watershed on mountains, you know, the water goes in off the ridgeline, it goes this way and this way. And all that means is it was a date you remember. And so that's what you benchmark what happened before that particular moment and what you remember after that moment. And you know, you can only imagine the generations that were not too far removed from the flood. I'm sure that the earth, it took a long time to spring back a lot. But just, you know this, we live in a destroyed earth. We're living in that post-flood period. And everything we see is still an earth that was destroyed. And I believe there's lots of evidence that we can go through and go, that is evidence of a global flood, and that is evidence that God destroyed the world. It's evidence that God made a judgment on man and interacted with that. So when we see a rainbow, you know, a lot of times you see rainbows and pictures, and there's like butterflies and there are birds, because rainbows are pretty nice. Actually, the rainbow was God saying, you know, I'm not going to destroy the earth again like that. Which leaves open, you know, until the earth, as long as the earth is there. But that doesn't mean, but implied in that is there's going to come a day when the earth is going to end. And so really the rainbow might be a little sobering, should be sobering, and it is a confirmation that God did place a judgment. And then through the Bible, there's lots of occasions where God places judgment on people. That did not end. Psalm 104, the psalmist writes, he set the earth on its foundation so it never be moved. You covered it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains. At your rebuke, they fled. At the sound of the thunder, they took flight. The mountains rose, the valleys sank to the place you appointed for them. You set a boundary. They may not pass. They may not again cover the earth. Jesus talked about the flood in Matthew 24, and he's talking about the judgment and how people were caught unaware. He says, for in those days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage till the day when Noah entered the ark. And they were unaware until the flood came and swept them all away. What do you picture that society like that God placed a judgment on and decided he was going to wipe it out? How was that? I kind of depicted it as chaotic. Somebody told me that latest movie about Noah I didn't watch. Kind of, lack of a better word, kind of a Mad Max type, you know, just total societal breakdown. But in this verse it says, you know, there are people that were marrying and giving in marriage. It was a society So, again, we don't know a whole lot of details. We know they were violent. You know, it was mentioned. Violence was mentioned. Again, I often catch myself going, how are we not worse than that generation? And maybe it is that God has just decided not to pass judgment like them. But I would be curious as to what that generation was like in 1 Peter. Peter mentions the flood a couple of times. Talked about they did not formally obey when God's patience waited in the days of Noah while the ark was being prepared, in which a few, that is, eight persons, were brought safely through the water. 2 Peter 3, they deliberately overlook this fact, that the heavens existed long ago, the earth was formed out of water and through water by the word of God, and that by means of these the world that then existed was deluged with water and perished. New Testament confirms and talks about the flood. So we ought to, again, I mentioned we ought to be able to then be able to see several examples of that. Where the water came from, and a lot of times people didn't have a good answer of where that water. They said, well, it came from underneath. That's what the scripture said, scientists said. There's not that much water. This was from a couple of years ago. They found big freshwater reserves underneath, and they're pretty excited about that, but that wouldn't explain that. It's probably within the last 2 years, these articles started to come out that they found evidence of a vast amounts of another ocean 10 miles underneath that they scientists speculate contains three times the water of the oceans. Which, again, follows the Genesis account of where that all that water came from and where all that water went. Here's some evidences that I think are fascinating. You know, I looked around and I was reading blogs, and they were mostly atheist blogs, and they were dealing with the flood, and it was ridiculing, but or making counter arguments. And one that I noticed that everybody just kind of passed on, and that's this: fossilized clams. A fossil, just real quick, and I happen to like fossils, and if I find one, I kind of collect it. And this is a seashell that, and so here's what happens: it gets buried in the mud, and then your soft insides die, and then slowly, fine silt forms in, and then hardens, and then at some point it cracks, and then somebody walks up and they find it. And so this is the inside of that shell. And so usually, soft bodies and tissues. So this is a clam fossil. It's a clam fossil. It's closed. What's kind of interesting about that, and this was given to me 2 weeks ago by Patty's granddaughter. You remember that, right? It broke. I broke it. I'm sorry. But it was like this. That's how clams die. Clams die, and shells go open every time. Clams die, shells go open. When you find a clam fossil that is like this, what that means is that clam got buried and didn't have and got killed, didn't have time to dig out or get out. And so then it died like that. Guess what they found when they started climbing these high mountains, Everest and in Peru, they get to the top of these mountains and they find clam fossils in a closed position. And these are giant clam fossils. This is a picture from Peru. Clam fossils in a closed position. And then piles of clams, fossils, closed in a dead position. In a closed position. All over the world, there are places where you can find these 3 feet deep. And that can only happen because they were caught off guard, had a ton of dirt dumped on top of them, and they died like that. all over the world on top of mountains. Now, they, you know, skeptics will say, plate tectonics, that was that was an ocean, and then it pushed up, and then it raised all that. But they don't have a good answer for what are all these clams doing closed in piles, dead, all over the world. That would be a sign of a complete global flood. And so, if we could continue to just say, what about this, and what about this, and what about this, then we build a strong case. If we build a strong case of a global flood, then you got to acknowledge God's existence, and you got to acknowledge God's judgment. In Romans, it reminds me of this, when he says, who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth? For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them, for his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, has been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that he has made. So they're without excuse. In the things that he's made, in the things that he made that he destroyed, and there's evidence just by the fact that they exist in the things that he made, and there's evidence in the things, the earth that he destroyed. So this is the world as it currently stands, and the forest areas are depicted here on this map. As you can tell, Texas is not listed as a forest. Maybe a little bit there in East Texas is a forest. It doesn't mean there's not green there. It just means that's not a forested area. You know, it's speculated that, you know, there's at least twice the landmass pre-flood that there was, and that it was evidence that it was a huge percentage of it was completely forested. You know, they drilled down and they started exploring the poles, and they drilled down and guess what they found? They found fossilized forests underneath there. Which, isn't that interesting? That tends to support the biblical account about, you know, in the Bible, in Genesis, it talks about a canopy being over the earth. And so an even temperature globe. And scientists don't really talk about, well, how did that work? If there wasn't that, I'm going to turn off my phone. You guys are texting me while I'm teaching class. And, you know, some other things, I didn't even go over these, but, you know, I also read, you know, some blogs about talking about the earth spin, and they said, you know, the earth is slowing down every year by some fraction of a second. And they go, you know, if you want to say that it was millions of years old when the dinosaurs were here, they'd have been spinning off because of how fast the earth would have had spun. Okay, so let's get back to that vegetation. So, so picture this. Maybe there's 20 times, maybe 100 times the vegetation that the current earth has all over. Huge amounts of biomass. And the global flood just takes all that, and it's all just, you know, ripped up, and it's floating through the oceans in huge mats the size of Texas. And then that sinks. And because this is big, you know, I don't picture that as clear water. I picture that as all, you know, chocolate looking. What, has anybody been down by the, I know Larry has because he's got a fascination with this. When we're hitting these floods and you live by the river, what does that Guadalupe, what does that look like when it's flood stage? Yeah, but I mean, it's brown. It's brown. I mean, it's got mud flowing through it. It's, you know, it's, and it's changing stuff. Trees are coming through and ripping through. So, Brennan, this guy that put this forward, and I think it sounds more plausible than anything else about the oil reserves. He said, you know, you got all this mass vegetation and buried in, you know, huge amounts of dirt, and that explains all of the accumulations of oil reserves that we have globally. What do you taught in school? Where did oil come from? dinosaurs. Yeah, I mean, it was Exxon used to be called Sinclair, and their symbol was a brontosaurus, and so fossil fuels. I mean, they're called fossil fuels. I mean, what that would, they would say, yeah, that process should still be going on. Something dies, and then maybe gets buried. But what we observe is, unless it's a special event, something dies that turns into dirt. Animal dies, turns into dirt. Buried, turns into dirt. It would take huge amounts with a lot of pressure to do that. The flood describes the deposition of all of that vegetation perfectly, because otherwise you wouldn't have the vast sizes of oil fields that you have, you know, throughout the world. So we've got, within our lifetime, within not all of our lifetimes, except for this group over here, a whole lot of our lifetimes, we had an event that happened in Washington State that should be a great case study on, that depicts a lot of things we see around the world and makes sense about, reinforces the flood. And that was Mount St. Helens. Mount St. Helens started to have some activity. So, everybody, the police and everybody started warning everybody within this proximity, you need to get out. And there are some people that refused to do it, and they're buried under a lot of ash somewhere. But the mountain blew up, as volcanoes do. Mount St. Helens was a volcano, and so they knew it was going to happen. I didn't know when it was going to happen, and I don't know the date, but it was sometime in 1980 that this happened, that a third of the mountain just went into the air. This is dirt, this is rocks, this is house-sized chunks of ice. Because remember, this is, up on top of a mountain. And, that volcanic ash, we got it on our cars. People in New York City got it on their cars. People nearby, they lost houses, they lost cars. They're entombed in those. And so it caused these huge mud, because all this ice started melting that's up there. It caused these huge mudslides to occur. And there's after it, so it's not, it's a lesser mountain than it used to be. Mountain before, mountain after. That's a lot of dirt. I read how many cubic yards of dirt each person that lives on the earth would get if they were to get the dirt, from this mountain exploding. And so it all rushed down, on all sides. There's lots of things that have happened that are interesting about this, and I'll talk about each one. And what we observe that would have happened during the flood. So big slide goes down. It literally fills a valley with this fast-moving mud and rock and dirt, and it's hot. It's bubbly. And this is it, flowing down, and these big ice would get buried and they'd explode because they'd flash in the steam. And so what happened was it cut off this little river. And pretty far up, it just, made a huge dam across this river. So the river, of course, stopped flowing on the backside of it. And it took months, but it slowly started to fill up with water. And this big, huge, filled up valley that it wasn't there, but prior to the explosion, got backfilled with this, a lake formed. And then it burst through. And it happened in the middle of the night. So they don't have any good pictures of it, when it happened. But it cut through. And overnight it cut this valley. And those of you who have been on Ken Holliday's tour, something similar happened up here when the dam burst over and overfill, and it just carved through. But what's interesting in this case is, it carved through dirt and rock that wasn't there, that had just been formed within the last couple of months, that wasn't there before. And so what it produced, and you see that person kind of, you know, how deep one section of it was, what it produced was strata. It was interesting, you know, the strata that somebody years from now that may not remember this will look at this and say, this was 4 million of years ago, and these are the, this is, you know, this period, and this is this period, and this is this period. But it sorted itself out, and that's what that looked like. And that wasn't there before. That happened in all an incredibly short period of time. That happened, and so that was all at one point soft before it started to harden. And one interesting thing that they see in a lot of places around the world is they'll see these strata that will be bent, and because, you know, things move, and so they, you know, they crumple up, you know, during earthquakes and stuff like this. And so science will tell you, you know, this is, you know, plate tectonics, and it moves slow, and it does this. I don't care how slow you try to bend a rock's going to break. There's no, I'm going to just put this kind of force on it for a million years, and I'm going to bend that rock. You'll fracture that rock, but you won't bend that rock. And so when you observe formations like this, that was soft when it was bent. There's no fracture in any of that rock. It was soft. And so again, that describes what we observed in that Mount St. Helens event, with the rapid laying down of strata that occurred over days because of the rock slide. That would describe that. So another interesting thing that happened, and, you know, Chris and I were up there, I want to say 15 years, you know, after it happened. And it looked like it just happened. It was, you look out over miles, and it looks like you're looking over piles of toothpicks. All these pine trees were just blown down as far as the eye could see. And there was a lake. There is a lake that is next to it. And you can see the volcano in the background, so you can kind of still, it's not like right next to it. And a lot of trees were blown into this lake. So, and that's this the big, that those are trees that you're looking at there. I think I got another. Yeah, and there's a photo of them in 2009. That was, you know, almost 30 years afterward. Yeah, you can go up there. You can fly up there today. There's trees floating in this lake. So what happens is these trees are floating in their rock, and so they're getting stripped of bark, and the bark is floating down. They're getting stripped of branches because they roll on each other, and they're pretty much nice straight trees after a period of time. And what happens is they get waterlogged, and a whole lot of them will tilt root down, and they'll sink into the mud. And then debris will start to form as you know, stuff is still falling off all these things, but that's organic matter. And so, you know, this is that will form into coal as dirt, you know, piles on top of it. And so you would think that we would see what we observe happening at Spirit Lake. We would be able to look and say that had to have happened during the flood on a huge scale all over the world. And what would we expect to see? And of course, you know, all the matter flowing to the bottom, as I talked about the oil fields. And so that's what's happening. They're seeing these trees get waterlogged, and they're going root down, and they're dropping, and like they were trees. And so here's the process. So they're dropping down. I mean, some go sideways, but some drop straight down, and then they get rock and other stuff that's still floating through the water and piling up around it. And this is a sonar, and they're you know, they've gone underwater, and they've looked and said, yeah, this is really fascinating because this is what's happening in Spirit Lake. And so We see this in the fossil remains. We see this all over the place. There's a whole national forest called here in the United States called a petrified forest. And that's petrified trees that are standing upright. Doesn't make any sense for a tree to die and then slowly, you know, dirt, you know, kind of starts building up and starts, you know, going. No, that trees rot and they go away. Bugs, animals, all kinds of things will eat out in trees. So the only way to explain all the petrified trees that we see is that they happened just like we observed them happening due to that Mount St. Helens event, that those trees were then buried pretty quickly over a couple of years in piles. And so and then, you know, as I explained about the fossil, you know, the wood rot, you know, they're in piles of dirt and that's hardens, and the wood rots away and then fine silt fills in. And it's so when you look at if anybody's ever, you know, seen a petrified tree or petrified wood, it's not the wood that turned to stone. It's an image, it's an encasing of what the wood used to be there. And that's all fossils are, not really bone. They're really just what was left over. So here's things that are, you know, are listed in books or websites. Scientific oddities. I always find that interesting. Scientific oddities. Scientific oddity is, how do we have a fossil that shoots through several periods of geological time? We got trees shooting through geological time. They've even found animal fossils shooting through geological time. There's a lot of them. And this is actually a duplicate of a fossil that exists. And this one, you know, and this is what they call a polystrate tree. It's going through several different stratas there. And so that matches. I mean, that you know, you got scientists who speculate, here's what I think happened, but there's nothing better than to be able to go, here's a case study, and let's enlarge this on a global scale. Doesn't that make more sense, that, you know, how that happened than before? And I really like this last example here. Diatomaceous earth is what a white powder is called, and they make all kinds of stuff out of it. They put it in filters and things like that. A diatom, I guess a diatom, is a microscopic animal, and that's what it looks like under a microscope. That's the, you know, little calcium structure or whatever that is. And that those things will float around in the ocean. And, you know, they'll eventually die off and fall to the bottom. And over a couple of hundred years, you might be able to measure that fall off in microns. But, you know, they apparently have, like, these deposits of these in different places around the world. California is one of them where they have large deposits of diatoms. And they're mining these, and I want to say back in the late 70s, what they found was they found a whale skeleton buried in the diatomaceous earth. Almost, I don't know if it was upright, because actually one of the blogs, an atheist blog, was saying, oh, it wasn't really upright, it was at 45 degrees. And I'm thinking, you know, that kind of, not the point. The point is, how did a whale die and get buried in diatoms? How did you don't really see, whales tend to get savaged pretty easily, and they float down to the bottom of the ocean, and then they get picked off by scavengers. There's nothing left. Even the bones are deteriorated. So what would it take to have a whale buried before it could rot in diatoms? It would take the oceans of the deep opening up because of lava activity or whatever, and you're shooting out, you know, steaming or hot water, killing off vast ocean, vast sections of the ocean, diatoms dropping out, precipitating out in mass, and swirls collecting in certain areas and burying animals like it did this whale. A whale buried in diatoms. I mean, that's just, you know, that's fascinating to me. And they didn't even really get this off. You know, I was reading some blogs about, okay, where's this sitting? And somebody had kind of like, they didn't ferry it to a museum. It was kind of sitting in the truck for years, and a tree was growing on top of it. But it was recorded, and it was documented by a lot of people who found it. And they're also finding these guys, they say the workers there, they're working these, they're finding fossils in these diatoms all the time. Nobody stopped and thought, how do you get that many diatoms? You know, how do you just do that? You don't. Again, I go back to this chapter in Romans, where, you know, when you walk out and you see the earth and you see God's hand in creation, and then because you kind of know what to look for, you go, okay, I now see evidences of a global wide flood. We're living in a destroyed earth. It doesn't have the vegetation that it used to. How can we not acknowledge God? And Paul says, because people refuse to listen to the truth. They refuse that. I mentioned this was, I think, it's good talking points for people. And I find examples of evidences of flood, of the flood, to be fascinating and just fun to have conversations. About 5-6 days ago, in holiday, dropped me a note and said, hey, can you take my class? I'm doing, covering these chapters, which I noticed was a flood. And he goes, I want you to talk about judgment and the covenant. I want you to emphasize that. Ken Holiday's not here, and he's not the boss of me. So I can cover whatever I want to in this chapter. But as far as he knows, we talked about judgment and the covenant. Everybody got that? Repeat that. Judgment and the covenant. So I guess I will mention that since I got 4 minutes. Chapter 8 talks about the covenant. And I know I've heard Ken talk about this a lot. So, it's you know, that's really Ken's thing. I hate to kind of, you know, try to be Ken. I already told you before, I'm doing good to be me. But in chapter 9, you know, we do find a covenant. As I talked about before, the rainbow is, you know, God saying, when you see this, this is a reminder of that I won't destroy the world by a flood. But there was a covenant that was made there. You know, we talked about this before. What's a covenant? It's an agreement. And it's not that man really had to say, I didn't agree to that. It is kind of a, you know, God saying, I'm telling you what I'm going to do. And then God has, you know, God puts some restriction on man. And so this was a covenant that was put back then. There's several. Okay. Where does it talk about not eating the blood? Now, does that talk about shedding blood? Were things strangled by blood? And I've heard Ken talk about this before, and I have no reason to doubt Ken on this, but, you know, he'll make the point that this covenant had never actually expired. You know, this is an ongoing covenant, and that makes sense to me because, you know, we know that the Mosaic covenant was one that was superseded. But the covenant that he's made with us, with Christ, is the one that ensures our salvation. These chapters are evidence that God has not changed. He didn't suddenly, you know, I heard somebody one time say, you know, that God of the Old Testament, that was a wrathful God. God doesn't change. God still feels the same way about wickedness and violence that he felt back then when he made a judgment against man. And he has promised another judgment. And the verses we talked about in Peter, and the verses that Jesus said, this is going to be like the flood. And he said, there's going to be people that are going to be going about their business and they're not paying attention. They haven't been paying attention, and they're going to be caught up in that judgment. But he says, like Noah, those people who listen to God are going to be spared. We've talked about covenant. We talked about judgment. So you guys can report that dutifully to Ken Holiday. And appreciate your attention. We'll close the class right there.